Good morning. You could get me to start talking about the work of the rescue mission, and it would take a lot longer than we have, but it is a phenomenal place where we see the work of God in our community, because hopelessness is hopelessness no matter where you are. And if you're in Santa Barbara, it's neat, and it's so fantastic and such an honor to be really what I consider in a front row seat to watch God work in the lives of people whose lives can be transformed by the work of hope. But it's great to be here with you this morning, and I can't talk exhaustively about the rescue mission, but being that I'm on a college campus, you know, you will one day realize that you feel like you just walked off a college campus. You feel like, oh, I must look like a student, I must blend in. But then you'll have an experience like I did 2 weeks ago of dropping my son off at a college campus, and you realize, wow, time really has passed. And by the way, call your parents, okay? It really means a lot to us. Your parents love you. It's just nice to hear from your kids. So anyway, enough about me. Well, actually, the next 50 minutes are about me. Sorry. But I want to tell you about a friend I met. Her name is Quantavia. Quantavia has to be one of the biggest divas I ever met in my life. I was fresh out of college and out to save the world. And so I moved into South Central Los Angeles with a passion to reach teenagers and gangsters. People in my new neighborhood didn't really know what to make of me. The only white guy on my block, and frankly, for blocks and blocks and blocks. And I didn't get a lot of visitors for quite a few reasons. I think a lot of people actually said they thought I was an undercover cop who was a little unclear on the concept of blending in. But largely it was the fact that I was so unfamiliar to my new neighbors in my community. But four-year-old Quantavia was the exception. She was intrigued with me, and she pretty quickly found out that I was a softie with the inability to say no. And so while all the other kids were in school and Quantavia was rarely supervised, she would come and visit me about 5 times a day. You know, she would demand that I twirl the jump rope, that we play a game, that we read a book or do something. And every time when she would get tired, she would say, okay, Rolf, I'll see you tomorrow, and walk out the door. And I knew that tomorrow could often mean as little as 15 minutes into the future. And there were times when I'd had enough or I was busy and I didn't want to open the door. But Quantavia would not give up that easily. And this four-year-old little girl could stomp around on my front porch, could scream my name. She actually figured out a way that if she lay down on her back, she could kick the doorpost hard enough that the entire house would shake as if an earthquake. And eventually, she knew that I would open up the door. One of Quantavia's favorite activities was a game that we came to call Roll Dem Balls, which took place on the old pool table we had in the house. Quantavia was too little to use the cues, so we put her up on a milk crate. She would roll the balls, I'd stand on the opposite end of the table, and we'd roll the balls back and forth. They would hit, they would collide. Great fun. So just about every day, there would be kind of a knock on the door and a pounding, and suddenly I would hear kind of through the mail slot, Ralph, open the door! I gotta roll them balls! We gotta roll them balls, Ralph, come on! And so we would go and roll them balls. And there was one afternoon in the midst of an extended session of Roll Dem Balls when I heard the mail come through the mail slot. And there I found the latest issue of my Stanford University alumni magazine. And I put it on the edge of the pool table and started to flip through. If you're really skilled at Roll Dem Balls, you can multitask. And you'll find the most interesting part of your alumni magazine are the class notes at the back where you can flip and you can find out some of the things that your classmates are up to. And as I stood there, munching a Hot Pocket with my other free hand, I started to get really depressed. Because people were getting advanced degrees. People were traveling the world. People were becoming partner in their firms. They were taking companies public. And suddenly, I just caught a reflection of myself in the window, standing there, unshowered, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, in sweats, holding a Hot Pocket, and playing a stupid game with a four-year-old girl. And I just thought, man, you're going places, man. This is awesome. Come on, Quantavia, roll them balls, baby. Well, it wasn't some well-executed plan that had me on the other end of that pool table from Quantavia, but there were a few specific promptings along the way that got me there. One of them was a beautiful spring afternoon where I was attending a class during my junior year at Stanford. I was in a class at the Stanford Quad in a discussion section for a class that was called Poverty and Ethnicity in Urban America. And about a dozen of us were sitting there sharing observations and, more importantly, positing solutions to all the kind of problems besetting America's inner cities and the people that lived there. And as I looked out the window and kind of gazed at the beautifully manicured environment, I was suddenly struck by this incredible sense of irony. Because here we were discussing blight, injustice, and suffering in inner cities on a campus environment that was so intentionally insulated from all of that. And I just wondered to myself, you know, who are we kidding here? I mean, we talk a pretty good game, but which one of us is actually going to live our lives differently and do something about this? And when I coupled this conviction with what I was discovering of Jesus as I studied the Gospels through the University Christian Fellowship Group I was a part of, instead of leading me just a few miles down the peninsula into the Silicon Valley with the rest of my graduating class, or some, most of them, it led me into South Central Los Angeles. And along the, after a few stops along the way, to Yananali Street here in Santa Barbara. Now, in the world's eyes, I was not destined to end up in places like this. It might be embarrassing to own this in some circles, but frankly, I am a person of privilege. I can't deny that. I had an upper middle class upbringing. I wanted for nothing. I had an outstanding education. I just told you I went to school. But before you get too impressed with the whole Stanford thing, I gotta give you a disclaimer. True story, when I first arrived on the Stanford campus, there were some ladies in the dorm on the floor below me that thought I was the janitor. It happened. It was kind of one of those awkward kind of conversations that happen in March when you're talking about first impressions and what you thought of each other. And, you know, Springsteen was all the rage and kind of the working man chic was wearing. And I guess I played the part. They saw me carrying stuff to the dumpster and they just thought I was the janitor. And I said, you know, awkward conversation, like, well, you know, you just didn't look like somebody who went to Stanford. And I said, yeah, but I was at the mixers, I was at the parties, I was dancing. And they said, yeah, we thought it was cool. They invited the janitor to come to the parties. So anyway, but that notwithstanding, that's where I'm from. And so I've always felt a bit disingenuous to say some of the things that we typically say about the Christian faith. It feels disingenuous to say that Jesus brought hope into my life because, frankly, the deck was so heavily stacked in my favor in this world. And so because of that, my faith and my journey with Jesus has always been driven by an intrigue and a curiosity and a wonder and a desire to see how does the hope of Jesus operate in lives and situations that are truly desperate. And that has required something very unnatural to the way I've been conditioned. It's a letting go of status and of right and of privilege. Well, Philippians 2 reads this way. It says, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness or compassion, then make my joy complete by being of like-minded, having the same love, being of one spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or conceit. Rather, in humility, value others as greater than yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. In your relationships, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, and in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. There's a very low audience threshold for the instruction Paul is giving there. He uses the word any four times in verse 2 to indicate that this is basic stuff for everyone. Do you have any encouragement from being united with Christ? Do you draw the least bit of comfort from his love? Are you at all tender or at all compassionate? Okay, then if any of these are the least bit true, then this is what your life should look like, and this is what you should be doing. We are to let go of our own ambition. We should be humble. We should value others as greater than ourselves and look to their interests. Now, I'm aware this is Westmont and there are biblical scholars in here, and frankly, that makes me more than a little uncomfortable. But I have to acknowledge that I understand Paul is giving this instruction to the church at Philippi and how they're supposed to relate to each other. And this morning, I'm going to extend that to the world beyond the church, because while this passage is dealing with the church and how it interrelates itself, it's very easy to make the case from the rest of Scripture that this is the posture that people who claim Jesus and follow Jesus should be extending to humanity as a whole. And to underscore this very straightforward and simple instruction, Paul draws from the example of Jesus. In the very poetic tribute that follows, he distinguishes between two very distinct and separate roles. First role is that of God, who there is one action under God's purview, that of exaltation. He is responsible for raising up and exalting. These fall exclusively to him. He doesn't need help with it. He doesn't delegate. He does not subcontract. He has the monopoly on exaltation. And only he can exalt Jesus and give him that name above all names. And he does so absolutely and completely. Jesus was not resurrected by his own doing, by any of his actions, the power of the human spirit within him, but because God took the action that only God could take. Now, Jesus plays that second role in this resurrection drama, that of submission and obedience. As Paul says, he empties himself, taking a route of downward mobility like no other, from absolute divinity to humanity. And then not just from human, but to enslaved human, to tortured human, all the way to condemned and executed human. And in emptying himself so completely, not only of anything divine, but really any shred of human dignity, Jesus left that work of exaltation completely and fully in the hands of God. Now, I've only got time to kind of talk briefly about, obviously, what requires a lot more exegesis and deeper theological reflection, but I'm interested really in what impact all of this should have on my life. And Paul outlines this response to us. While God's work is exaltation and Jesus' work is humiliation, ours is imitation. Paul exhorts us to be of the same mind and to have that same love as Jesus. I am called to imitate Jesus in the way that he emptied himself, refusing to cling to status or to right, and he trusted God completely to work on exalting and raising him up. Now, imitation may seem like a relatively straightforward calling, but that doesn't mean it's an easy one. Because exaltation falls completely in God's role, there's no place for me to self-exalt, which is frankly very challenging. We're to have nothing to do with selfish ambition or conceit. And on the one level, that could sound doable to me because I don't consider myself an out-of-control narcissist or anything like that. But if I look deeper, I have to own the fact that I am wired for assertiveness in a very competitive world. And God isn't telling me just to stay away from extremes, but to have absolutely nothing to do with that. And that's not so easy for me to do because I navigate my life with an air of self-importance. It takes only something as basic as a trip to Costco to kind of bring out my true nature. You know, from the moment I enter the parking lot, and those of you, you know, in Santa Barbara, I mean, when you lived in LA, Costco is a whole different, like, world of competition. It is battle. And you enter that parking lot and you start driving, and I am zipping through that parking lot past spots that might require me 20 seconds of walking to see if I can get one close to the store before anybody else can. And once I'm in that Costco with, you know, with my cart and my list, just stay out of my way. If you want to marvel at the 15-gallon vat of pickles, that is absolutely fine. Do not block the aisle when I'm trying to get down it, because I will kind of walk by, I'll mutter under my breath and give you the stink eye. I'll get to the bananas, I will go through those and kind of pick through, make sure I get the biggest and best batch. You leave your cart even blocking a little bit, I'll have no problem shoving my way through and mutter something about how inconsiderate you are. Until I see the enchilada samples, then I will leave my cart in the middle and just walk over there and pick through the stupid little tray to make sure that I get the biggest, like, cheesiest one. And then when you're approaching the checkout stand, I've got two things on my mind. First of all, the shortest line with the least apathetic-looking checker. And second of all, you know, the competition of other shoppers bearing down on me. And I've learned you never make eye contact, because it's a little harder to live with yourself that there is no way you're yielding to the guy with 9 cases of Twinkies on his cart, you know? But the fact is it's a silly example, but if you think about your day-to-day life in the dining hall, wherever, this is the way we're wired. I navigate everyday situations with such a small-minded self-centeredness. And the call on me to imitate Jesus challenges this. If I get this petty over the mundane, then God help me when there are more serious things at stake. And when I hear this admonition to have nothing to do with selfish ambition or conceit, and to count others better than myself, this is not just a caution to avoid extreme egomania, but to be vigilant in the way that I approach everyday situations, where I'm tempted to assert myself and to make sure I get my due. But even this runs contrary to our conditioning. It's good to know our strengths, it's good to possess appropriate self-confidence, but it's very easy for us to stray into exalting ourselves. Because at the simplest, the definition of exalting myself is simply to put myself first. And I'd suspect that most of us wouldn't fall into some blatant practice of self-exaltation where we're going to demand adulation and praise from people. But we're pretty good at this subtle posture of putting ourselves, our needs, our interests first. We can be overly concerned with our own development, our career aspirations, the opportunities we want to pursue, or things for our family. And that runs contrary to what Paul is talking about in Philippians. We aren't called to take care of others' needs after ours are met. We're not called to take care of other needs as long as they don't hinder ours from getting met. Our lives are to be marked by the way that we elevate the importance of others and their needs, even if it might require us going without or our lives looking markedly different. Regarding others as better than myself means yielding in the midst of the posturing and jockeying for position that is so ingrained in me. It means I'm not too important to be second in line. It means I'm not too educated or accomplished to be playing rolled in balls with Quantavia. Only God has the power to raise and exalt. I need to stop grabbing it for my own. Jesus calls me to be as committed, if not more, to see that other people's needs are taken care of. Do I have that same zeal or focus or intensity that I have of my own needs as I do for the interests of others? Am I as attentive to the little things and inconveniences in their life as I am to the petty things that I find myself dwelling on in my own twisted internal monologue? My unvoiced concern shouldn't be that I'm not getting the best parking spot, but maybe that there is somebody out there circling the parking lot who really needs it. And maybe there's somebody that needs to get through the check stand faster than I do. But beyond everyday circumstances, what's more important is that there are situations around us and in our world where people's needs are intense and extremely urgent, and looking to them will require something more than just yielding our place in line. The first step in looking to the interests of others is at least to stop being fixated on our own interests long enough that we might even take notice of what someone else's needs is. But from there, a commitment to the interests of someone else might involve life-altering implications. I have a friend, Ermias, who told me a story about the man he worked for in the remote Ethiopian village where he lived. This boss was a cruel, demanding man who treated Ermias unfairly and often ridiculed him publicly in front of customers. But because of limited opportunities in the region and a family to feed, Hermias endured this treatment much longer than anyone would have expected him to. And to hear him tell it, he may have stoically endured and done this for years longer than anyone expected to, but inside he was resolved in his hatred of this man, and he spent hours of every day and week just fuming at him and longing for his destruction. Well, it didn't surprise Hermias one night when there was a knock on his door and the man was there, as it wouldn't be uncommon to kind of receive a late night tongue lashing or some final after hours demand. But this man came to him with a tone of desperation and told Hermias that his 5-year-old daughter was extremely ill and needed medical attention. It didn't take long for Hermias to realize that because of this guy's reputation, there was a very short list of people he could ask for help at this time, namely one. And so he immediately agreed to go along. But what moved me most in the story was that the medical help they needed to get to was 8 days away on foot. And so saying yes to this man meant 8 long and painful days of walking, taking turns carrying the sick little girl across rugged paths, waiting weeks during her treatment, and then carrying her most of the way back as she wasn't strong enough to walk yet. And I can't think of a more vivid illustration of taking someone's interests as our own than what Hermias did. It required physical effort, incredible cost, and remarkable character. It required putting his family and his own interests aside. He didn't just express concern for this man. He didn't just wish him well, but he committed to his enemy and his daughter as if it were his own daughter. And even if I pledge to take the interests of others, I need to make sure that I don't confine this to my own preferred subgroup of others, perhaps those related to me by blood, by class, by race, by position, where helping them may make me look good, or where their interests may be closely enough allied to mine that helping them might also be giving me some tangential benefit. When I look at the chasm Jesus crossed from absolute divinity to humanity, I realize that truly taking the interests of others and owning their welfare, even if it's our enemies, is something we need to do, even if there's no benefit to be reaped in return. The 10 years I lived in Quantavia's neighborhood were hopefully marked by someone who was trying to do this, trying to give priority to the needs of others instead of chasing a coveted career track. And for the last 8 years, I've been privileged to work in a place where I continually see the people of God in our community looking beyond their own interests and making incredible commitments of their lives and resources to see that the needs of people who are struggling, the homeless and the addicted in our community, are met. And there's often a moment of awkwardness if I'm getting acquainted with somebody or if I'm giving them a tour at the rescue mission facility. There's often a moment of awkwardness that emerges because every night of the year, we have over 200 people under our roof who otherwise would not have a place to eat or sleep. It's not the Biltmore, and it's certainly not the Biltmore crowd, if you know what I mean. And people will have long conversations with themselves and other things. And so no matter what, if you're walking through the rescue mission, there is a low level of chaos that will quickly interrupt any tour or any visit, often does. And it's sometimes in the middle of this that I'll get this kind of puzzled look and this puzzled comment where somebody asks for clarification, saying, "Wait a minute, did you say you went to Stanford?" Because frankly, I love that because obviously the expectation is that somebody of my pedigree would not end up in a place like this and would be on a completely different career path. Well, let me tell you something. The place that you are getting a degree from carries similar status. You're probably well aware that a degree from Westmont can be used and include opportunities for incredible success and accomplishment and recognition. But there is a risk that we make if we put pursuing these things a priority in such that it causes us to look back and completely ignore the desperation of others and the desperation in our world around us in which we live. And it's so hard to let go of this, but that is where Paul's example of Jesus in the incarnation, stripping himself of divinity, serving humbly and completely unconcerned with self-assertion, is such a helpful model to me in that it leaves that work of exaltation completely with God. And if my calling is to imitate Jesus, then any attention I pay to self-aggrandizement is futile and misplaced. You know, the human body is not designed to fly. You know, I can flap my arms with all the fury I might muster, and it won't move me an inch through the ground. Yet reclining and asleep, I can sit in a chair and I can fly at 30,000 feet across continents and across oceans, provided I am in an airplane that is performing the role that it was designed to do. And there really is no comparison. Once I realize the good that an airplane can do me in traveling and how much more effectively can fly, it borders on the ridiculous for me to try and get there on myself by flapping my arms. And in the same way, for me to engage in any kind of self-exaltation is ridiculous, because in the resurrection, God has done this so completely that there is not one iota of effort that I can contribute. So my proper response is simply to empty myself, to move away from misguided attempts to secure my own glory, and instead focus my energy on others and their welfare as I give my all to imitating Jesus. And that is my prayer, that this would be your call and conviction too. Thanks very much.